hold a lot of power, each of us, in our hands. We hold the power of how we spend our money, called citizen commerce by my guest today. Are you aware of how much power that is? When you shop, do you think about what values you're reinforcing with how you spend your money? Do you shop with local small businesses or with retail chains? Do you look for eco-friendly products or organic products, or just focus on price? My guest today made it easier to shop responsibly, supporting local, innovative entrepreneurs around the country, including those who make eco-friendly products. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we bring you insights and tips from remarkably innovative women, particularly around corporate responsibility, energy, and sustainability-related issues. I'm Joan Michelson. We talk about innovation, leadership, technologies, and careers, always bringing a new perspective. Find us anywhere you like to listen to podcasts, as you obviously did today, on greenconnectionsradio.com, our website, and through my Forbes blog as well. And please pass it on to your friends. If you want to gain insight from more women like me and our accomplished guests, join one of our mastermind groups. We'll help you with contacts, resources, strategies, ideas, and tips to save you time and money as you grow your career or your business, no matter what industry you're in. As a listener of Green Connections Radio, especially around the holidays, you may have heard my guests today talking about their latest eco-friendly gifts. Jules Pieri is the co-founder and CEO of The Grommet, an online shopping site that only sells products made by local small business entrepreneurs, and all their products are pre-screened and tested to be considered worth sharing with The Grommet's community of about 3 million people. She hails from the corporate world, having started her career as an industrial designer for technology companies and was a VP of strategic planning at KEDS, StrideRight, and Play School. Strategic planning is her strength, and obviously now being an entrepreneur is as well. And she's also just recently published a great new book called How We Make Stuff Now, Turn Ideas into Products That Build Successful Businesses. I'd like you to meet Jules Pieri of The Grommet, and here we go. Welcome back to Green Connections Radio, Jules, and thank you for making time for us.
I'm so happy to be here, John.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So let's jump right in. First of all, tell us why you decided to write this book and why now.
Well, we've launched 30,000 products from 3,000 companies, and you learn a lot watching that much activity in young, you know, small businesses. And they uniformly have a great innovative product, or they wouldn't become a Grommet. But there's a heck of a lot of other stuff they have to get good at in order for that product to ever see the light of day. Everything from shipping to financing to marketing to protecting their intellectual property. And, you know, I've had a front seat and, frankly, the privilege of both helping those people and also learning from those companies. So it felt like the right time after almost 11 years to put that all in one place, because most of these folks are doing this in isolation. They aren't part of the more Inc. magazine startup community where they can sign up for accelerators and get a lot of support. They tend to be distributed all over the world, all over the country, and might have to work a little harder to find expertise and resources. So that's the book. There just wasn't a book like it out there. And to tell you the truth, if there had been, I wouldn't have written it, because I don't like doing something anyone else has ever done. But big, wide hole. So I tried to fill it.
So you said you helped launch 30,000 products. Are these products that had never been in the marketplace before they were on the Grommet, or were they in other platforms and are going to, you know, local flea markets and farmers markets and stuff before they came to the Grommet?
It's a pretty wide range. We look at 200 to 300 products a week, and we launch 5 or 6. And so we engage pretty deeply with about 30 companies a week. And within that 30 that we're evaluating, definitely all have their own website and have started some direct sales before we launch them. And we like that because they're learning about their customer and, you know, have more credibility, essentially, if they've started to operate a little bit. And like you said, they might be at farmers markets, and some limited local retail is kind of a fairly typical place where we meet folks. If they came out of crowdfunding, then they probably have a little bit more going on because they might have attracted some retail distribution through that process. And that would also be healthy. What we're looking for, though, is a product that still is relatively under the radar. If it's really well known, like we launched Fitbit. Now, if we launched Fitbit today, that you'd think we were like really kind of kooky telling you that we're discovering new product every day. So if it, you know, has really broken through, it won't be a grommet, but we love to meet those companies that deserve to break through.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about how they get screened, and I know I've seen some of the videos of you guys looking at how you evaluate products, but talk about how you evaluate, because, you know, of the 200 to 300 products you choose, you only choose a fraction of them to actually embrace. So take us through a little bit of how you evaluate products besides what, you know, where they've distributed so far, and also how you give them feedback or not, as the case may be, when they do apply and you choose them and you have some feedback for them, or maybe you decline to represent them, but you still have some feedback for them.
Sure. So the 200 to 300 a week, about half of them are inbound. So half of them, they don't even realize we're evaluating them. We've discovered them somewhere in our travels. Somebody, you know, I have 3 emails today from somebody telling me that a product is interesting. So I might be referring this product without anybody realizing that we're looking at it at a first blush. And the first blush is done by somebody in our company who has category expertise. You know, they are the person who understands outdoor gear or kitchen gadgets or that kind of thing. And so they've seen, you know, sort of in air quotes, everything. Like they actually have a very good understanding of what's out there and what the trends are in the space that they're operating, you know, that they're helping us operate in. So first cut is, okay, is this distinctive and interesting? Does this product have promise for what it says it does? And that's when it makes that cut, we'll contact the company and get samples. So that's the 25 or 30 a week. And then there are about 8 other things we're looking at that go beyond the product. We test the product. So like you mentioned at the intro, like that's very unusual. 99% of what you see online, nobody in that company has tested. And I mean specifically the marketplaces, the larger places where you might buy products. That's not their promise to you. Their promise to you is buyer beware. Like you decide what you want. That's up to you, but we will ship it to you. And, you know, it's not our promise that it will be anything more than show up, but we're the opposite. You know, we have personally tested these products. And then from there, we're looking at, does the company have intellectual property protection? Because Amazon's creating quite a threat to U.S. innovation because it's really enabling overseas counterfeiters to destroy a lot of innovation and small businesses. So we like to see some protection there because we can foresee problems if they don't have it. The company has to have margins that are sustainable for themselves and for, you know, partners like ourselves. We'd like to see an engaged founder because we're going to ask them to create media and help us answer questions that our community might have. So we don't deal so much with PR firms or people that are second, you know, third hand to the product's innovation. We're looking at, you mentioned earlier, distribution, but that's kind of sort of table stakes. Quality of packaging, if it's a product that would, if they'd like to go to physical retail, because we have a wholesale part of our business and you can get away with a poly bag in e-commerce. It's not great. It certainly isn't good for a gift to give to somebody, but once you hit retail, then your product's naked on the shelves. So you really need a credible package. So we'll look at that for a product that really should get to wholesale and be sold in retail environments. So those are some of the things we look at. It's 10 different things.
You wrote about a lot of this in your book. What you didn't write about, which you just alluded to a little bit, is the team and how you build the team and how you, when you're building a new business, et cetera, because your book is about building successful businesses ultimately, right? And you cover IP, and I definitely want to talk about the Amazon issue, new prototyping, industry access, marketing, distribution, packaging, et cetera, and even how to get paid. But what you don't talk about is building the team. And I think that's critical, especially for people who want to build a business. I mean, you have a business with values, right? You're not just about making money. You're a values-based business. And that's part of what I enjoy about following the Grommet. And you sell sustainable products, which we'll get into in a minute. But talk a little bit about how you have built the team and what you might do differently if you were doing it again.
That's so insightful that you picked that up, because people have told me this book is basically a handbook to creating a company, a startup handbook. Whether or not you're doing a physical product, almost all of the chapters have real relevance. But one time I remember somebody saying that, and I thought to myself, exactly what you said. Well, actually, half of building a company is building the team, and I don't address that at all in the book. It's more nuts and bolts, you know, stuff that is helpful, but not the whole story, really. And that's the part that was more accidental to me in terms of my learning how to do that. It's not something that I had fully appreciated before we started, and yet it becomes the first and most important job you do. Because when you start a company, or at least in our case, when we started, I couldn't afford to pay people what they were worth. So you immediately are thinking about, well, how can I make this a worthwhile experience if I can't do it only with cash, which a lot of jobs are, you know, that's a big part of the contract is the cash. And so one thing that was easy and obvious was the mission of the business wasn't as boringly the same. You know, we're very steady in our mission to really level the playing field for the little guy and support innovative products from young businesses. So that's super motivating to people. So you kind of have this huge leg and head start when you're recruiting somebody, if that matters to them. They won't join. If it doesn't matter to them, I don't want them to join because they won't enjoy the work. But that helps. But then after that, I think a lot of it initially is being, as a founder, being able to paint that vision, because it's not just the words I said, but being able to illustrate it and show personal commitment and enthusiasm for it. I'll give you an example of that. Last week, we had a really challenging week for a variety of reasons. And my co-founder, Joanne Domeniconi, went into a meeting, the weekly meeting where we review the new products. That was 25 or 30 a week. And one of our young employees, who could be a little rattled, say, by a rough week, wrote Joanne a text at the end of the day saying, "I just want to tell you how inspiring it was to me to see you with a smile on your face that entire meeting, being super engaged when you've been doing this for 11 years and it could be routine or boring and it looked like it was the opposite for you."
Oh, that's great. I love that. What a treat to get that, and such a surprise too.
Such a surprise. People don't think to tell, you know, somebody senior to them something like that, I guess. It was so nice that Joanne even sent it to me. I woke up, you know, Friday morning, I'm in the bathroom getting ready. This is last Friday. And she sends me that text. And it gave me a real lift too, just to know that she had been recognized and that it had that kind of impact on somebody in the business.
Yeah.
So that's a tiny microcosm of what a good startup leader does. Like, you're a little bit of a flight attendant. When last week you had a turbulent week, Joanne was a good flight attendant. She was truly, sincerely enthusiastic, truly, sincerely not worried about, you know, whatever somebody might have been worried about. She was able to do that sincerely. But as a leader, keeping your eye on where you're going, keeping people enthusiastic to be in those seats and wanting to go in the same direction is the most fundamental part of building a team.
Well, I also find that it's frankly therapeutic when you just get into doing the work and get away from the whatever the garbage is that's distracting you. I'll tell you a little story that happened to me. When I had my business in Las Vegas, out of the blue, I got a physical note from one of my staff left on my desk. And it was a card. And it said, "Thank you for being such a great role model. All of my friends complain about their bosses and their jobs and, you know, how what else they might want to do and how miserable they are. And I just really enjoy working with you and feel like this is, you know, you're helping me so much," and yada, and went on a little bit. And it was like, It was amazing because it wasn't Christmas. It wasn't my birthday. It wasn't around her review. There was no precipitating factor. It just showed up out of inspiration.
That's a mature person, though, and an empathetic person who does that. I think plenty of people think it, but they don't realize that the act of putting it down in a text or a note is what is the real distinction about that. What is exceptional about that?
Well, and it also goes to the fact that no matter whether you're an entrepreneur saying that to a client or an employee saying that to your boss in a big organization or a small organization, it matters because we're really quick to complain, but we're not so quick to say thank you and why.
I learned that in a different format. I have three sons, and when they were in the public schools where we lived, there was a program where we could give them what was called a Star Award, and there was a donation to an educational nonprofit, and the nonprofit would give them this certificate that they would usually put on their walls. It was a meaningful thing. But I always asked the organization to send me the stars and let me mail them because I wanted to add a letter. And that letter, which was specific about what I appreciated, I asked my kids, you know, which of your teachers should get a star and why? And, you know, so I wasn't making it up. I knew from the horse's mouth why. Those letters, I would hear back from them that might be the only letter they got this year, yet they had 25 students or even more in, say, a high school setting go through their classroom for an entire year and they get one letter, you know, that they deserve that letter.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I want to, before we get too far away from it, I'd like you to address this Amazon issue. And you write about it some in your book, and you talked about it when you were here doing your book tour in DC. But address this issue of, I've heard that Amazon is also seeing which products sell well and then basically knocking them off and giving them better rankings and all of that. Giving better rankings to their own product version of it. So I don't know if that's what you're talking about or if you're talking about other kinds of counterfeiting. So address that first. I think that's really important for people to know, especially because so many people shop on Amazon, right?
Here's what's happening where it affects the ordinary person. Amazon does two things that people don't realize. Number one, in 2015, they changed the rules so that people who wanted to sell into the United States of America market used to have to go through an intermediary, used to have a local rep. And Jeff Bezos is very, very concerned about competition from the Chinese mega marketplace, Alibaba. So he wanted to invite and see more competition from Chinese sellers on Amazon. So he lifted that rule all across the globe. And so it changed the game dramatically. It was super successful. So the Chinese suppliers flooded Amazon. So now today in 2019, 25% of what's sold on Amazon comes straight from a Chinese factory. And here's the deal. It's a very different business culture where counterfeiting is not a problem in China. We look down on it. We have legal protections in the US. No such thing in China. So 25% of what's sold on Amazon has the likelihood, the probability of being counterfeit product.
Wait a minute. 25% of what's sold on Amazon has the chance of being counterfeit?
Yes.
Wow.
And counterfeit is different than copycat. Copycat is capitalism. Like you see a product, you make it better. You figure out a way to improve on something. There's nothing wrong about copycats. I mean, when you have a product, you wish people didn't. But counterfeits are a really different thing because they're actually pretending to be your product. They use your brand name. In our case, our makers find that their own pictures or pictures of their kids that are on their original package end up on a Chinese counterfeit products package. Like I said, they use the product name, but these products are fake. They're cost reduced, so they always win the top listing on Amazon. They look like it's the real product, but just on some miraculously low price, the product is sold, the product is shipped, person receives it and thinks they got the real deal, but the product fails. And the entity they blame is the originator. The originator, who had nothing to do with this fake product, is blamed. The reviews are crummy, and there goes their business. So Amazon's power can very quickly, from the counterfeit standpoint, destroy a business.
So it's not that Amazon is doing this. It's that Amazon opened the door to counterfeiters who are putting out substandard products that under your brand, in effect, and that because they're substandard and don't perform, it tarnishes your own brand and can severely knock out your business.
Yes, that's one thing Amazon does. And that was unprecedented in the world, because traditional retailers, whether it's, you know, a department store or a local store or a chain like CVS, are in business for their customers to make sure that, you know, they've curated a product that's worthy of their brand's reputation. So they don't sell counterfeiters. That's one of the big roles of retailers in the world. It's a little bit like journalists. You know, journalists are in the business of promoting factual information, real journalists, not fake things. So retailers have played that same role in our society and our economy, and we are letting Amazon change the rules of the game, I guess, by supporting Amazon. But the other thing they do is the thing you actually said, Joan. What you're talking about is private label. And Amazon, it's one of the biggest growth areas in their business. So they have, last count, 125 private label businesses. And some of them, a few of them are called Amazon Basics. So you know you're buying from Amazon. They've taken over 40% of the battery market under that name, Amazon Basics Batteries. But 120 some of them are not under the name Amazon. They're under a fake name, or a made up name, not fake, but a made up name. You know, when you see like Birch Lane or, you know, Rocky River brand, these brands are Amazon's own brands, but they don't tell you they're their own brands. And they're looking at the data from what's selling from the hard, you know, the hardworking people who are selling their products on their site. And they're saying, oh, wow, that thing's going crazy. Let's make one of our own under our new brand name that we just made up. And because of the power they have to put that new Amazon brand at the top of the listings, those white label copycats, now in this case, they're not counterfeits, they're copycats, are winning the listings. And because of Amazon's economic might, they're also putting those businesses out of business. And that's why there's in your town, there's a lot of antitrust interest, because when you control the pipes, whether it's railroad or oil, or in this case, commerce, you're supposed to create a level playing field so that the whole economy, you know, and competitors, competition can be enhanced. Essentially, we all love competition. And when the entity like Amazon controls the road, you know, the pipes, and they can destroy competition, then we're actually going backwards. We actually have a problem without, you know, with competition. So people, you know, rightly so, have thought Amazon has done a lot for competition, because in their earlier days, they were creating like kind of a fair and transparent marketplace where, oh, wow, here's a new place to sell. But they've really changed to becoming much more of a net destroyer of innovation and a complete destroyer of competition. It's very bad for our economy, very bad for innovation, very bad for jobs.
That's interesting. Because what you're saying is, what I understand too, is that when they make these copycats, it's not just that they're putting it out to be competitive like any other one. It's that they're, because as you say, they control the pipes, they control the roads, they're rigging, in effect, the system, since they control it, to give their own product more exposure to people who are searching for those terms or those products, rather than allowing the natural course of capitalism to take its course.
Bingo, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, that's not a good thing. Talk about the sustainable products you have on your website. Some of the ones that I saw that were really intriguing were the biodegradable grill, which I think I mentioned to you when I saw you, and the, you know, glass straws, bamboo linen, things like that. I think the reusable beeswax food wrap, I think we might have even talked about once before, especially around the holidays when there's a lot of leftovers. And I think you said you use that too. Then I saw plant-based nail polish.
Yes. I mean, there's just a ton, like endless innovation in this area, because it's where people our focus. Essentially, when you think of values or sort of voting with your dollars, this is one of the very first things people would think of, because it's an area of concern and it's an area where people want to make a difference. So they're looking for better ways to do what they do. And better can mean, usually it means two things, like literally better, like, oh, I can, these say the beeswax, they actually really do as well to better job as they have better, they're better on another front, which is obviously better for the environment. And similar with Strawsome, the glass straws that you mentioned. And we just have a huge panoply of, like, when you think of whatever need you have in your life, whether it might be illuminating your, you know, outdoor patio to enjoy, you know, a barbecue. That Cassius barbecue grill that you mentioned comes from Denmark, and it is biodegradable. Every bit of it is biodegradable. So you're not, this is more of a portable grill. You probably would not, you know, use that on a daily basis at home, but plenty of us have portable grills that end up not being biodegradable, what we use, and not effective even. So yeah, these products are usually, you know, not a compromise, but an improvement in functionality. I use a laundry stain, two laundry cleaners that Romative launched that are all natural, one called Puracy and one's called Charlie's. And they both are just sort of miraculously effective, but also all natural. I wouldn't drink them, but you could.
So I can't imagine a biodegradable grill, because it sort of seems like it would, since it's, you put flames in a grill, that it would just burn up. But did you guys actually test that? I mean, did you like put it, take it outside and try to grill something on it?
Yes, of course. We test absolutely everything. So that one has, you know, the sort of gee whiz part is that it has lava rocks that form the, or it's really lava stone lining. And then it has bamboo charcoal briquettes. So the lava stone's keeping it from doing what you just feared, right? Like instantly disintegrating. And then the briquettes, you know, kind of self-destruct, I guess, is the best way to put it. So they last, you know, last long. You wouldn't barbecue all day on this grill. It has a time frame, but it's about 60 minutes. It gets to 400 degrees for about 60 minutes. So you can make a meal. You can't make, you know, an all-day barbecue.
Mm-hmm. And you can, do you have to throw it out when you're done with that one meal?
Yes, but it's biodegradable. You can bury it in your garden. You could put it in your compost.
Wow, that's cool. I might have to check out the plant-based nail polish too, because God, that stuff smells awful in a nail salon.
I was, you know, I'm always surprised when it's always women, of course, who paint their nails on a plane and or a train. And I had to test that product on a train. I mean, it was just super busy and like, oh no, I'm going to be that person. And I opened it up and sort of carefully smelled it and thought, there's no smell at all. And then I said to the man next to me, like, I promise you, if this has any fumes, any smell, I'll stop doing this. I just need to paint a couple, you know, I'd like to paint all my nails, but if I paint just a couple, you know, we'll know. And he's like, go for it. I don't care. And I got to paint all my nails because it didn't smell.
Wow, that's cool. One of the things you said, I want to talk a little bit about the business again and then just talk about you and let you go. But when you talked here in DC, you said something really interesting. We focus a lot on women in mid-career, whatever that means for the individual woman. And in your case, and in many cases today, women evolve differently, right? We take different paths. And you said one of the interesting dynamics for you was that when you started the Grommet, you were 47 and you were ramping up. And most of your friends were like thinking about slowing down and what they might do in retirement. And that was a shift for you. I mean, that was kind of a, you know, something that you had to deal with. And I mean, to be honest, I find that too. And I think we talked about that when I saw you. How do you finesse when you're in a different rhythm than the people you usually hang out with?
Honestly, that's one of the more difficult aspects of this journey, I would say, because when you're starting a business, you're not very available to begin with. Anyway, you're working so hard and so many hours. And so I had to sort of narrow down, no matter what my age would have been, I had to narrow down to focus on like the essentials, which for me were family, business, health, like exercise. And friends were the harder thing to get to. But then it was compounded because I didn't have a lot in common with the people that I, you know, previously had a lot in common with. I was so boring. Like, they weren't the boring ones. I was the boring one, because for, say, the first 4 or 5 years of the business, it was almost like when you have a baby, anyone who's, you know, a new parent can relate, like, your brain, it's not about the sleep. You're just so enraptured with that child that you can hardly think of anything else. And I was like that with the business. It was the biggest thing in the room. So while my friends were, you know, like you said, maybe had already had a long career and were dialing down, or they had stepped off the career train and they weren't really looking to get back on it. That happened too. But even my male friends, this isn't just about women. They were the ones who were more so like maybe, you know, kind of reaping the benefits of their hard-won success, where I was still looking to create it. I didn't have a lot in common with them. And I won't say I lost friends, because that makes it sound like somebody did something bad. But I sort of drifted away from some of those friends at that time. And I really value the friends who put up with me and sought me out and would meet me wherever they could, I could, you know, at some weird hour, or some weird place, or, you know, be okay with some level of digital communication instead of face-to-face or phone. So, you know, I've come out of that where I think I am a little more balanced, and I definitely have a little more time. But there was a cost there for me that I was conscious, because I've always been a really good friend, like a very responsive and available friend, and I wasn't. So consciously made the choice, and no regrets. But, you know, I'd be kidding myself, or being, you know, give a disservice to your listeners if I didn't acknowledge that. That's a sacrifice that I made.
Well, I'm glad you were candid about that. I mean, I've moved several times. I've lived in 8 or 9 states, depending upon how you count how long I lived there. And I find that it's always interesting. And of course, I'm doing businesses when a lot of people are slowing down or thinking about slowing down or whatever they want to do next also. And I find that both moving and being at a different pace, first of all, I make different friends in different ways, right? I meet more, I have a more multi-generational network and more across sectors, and sort of it ebbs and flows with what I'm involved in. But I also find it was always interesting to me of who stays in my world and who leaves. And it's like what you say, it's not that you lose them. It's just, it's drifting because there's less and less that you have in common, or it was convenient because you live next door and now you don't live next door anymore, kind of thing. So it's not a diminution of them, it's that, you know, priorities change, interests change, and there's still only 24 hours in a day, last I checked.
In my case, some of it was, I started the business when my kids were in sort of middle school to just entering college. So I was going to experience some of that shift anyway, because some of my friends were friends that were bound together. We were bound together by our children and their activities. And that was going to change anyway. So the whole thing gets a little compounded in that front as well for me. And, you know, I can't really separate them.
Yeah, no, I understand. What surprised you most about as you've been building the Grommet? I mean, you've been at this now, as you say, for 11 years, and you're in a new phase of it. What has surprised you the most, do you think?
I would say I shouldn't be surprised by this, but I am. I was surprised at essentially how long it takes for trends to really become dominant. And by that, I mean the things that we were playing with from the very beginning, not playing with, but doubling down on, were supporting companies with values and companies with stories. You just said an experience economy, like sharing, you know, the development of these products and who's behind them, that making it human. All that stuff seemed to me in 2007 and 8, when we really got started, like the next big thing. It just made sense to me, especially once the economy collapsed, because like we had a zillion reasons to distrust big entities, from government to big businesses and banking. But that was slower than I expected. I would say, you know, it's articulated right now as like obvious, but I thought it was obvious back then, and it definitely wasn't.
Oh, that's interesting. So you've made a number of transitions in your career. You've changed companies when you were in corporate America, and you decided to take the leap to the Grommet, and then, of course, to bring in your strategic partner. So what advice would you give to a woman in mid-career, whatever that feels like for her, who wants to use her education and her experience and her passion for making a difference in her career. But she also wants to make money and still get ahead. I mean, not somebody who is slowing down, but who is looking at what do I, you know, I feel like I want to do something other than what I'm doing. What would you suggest to her?
Well, whether it's entrepreneurship or a career shift, I think it's hard to find in the media role models that give us the encouragement to do that. And so I guess I'm saying to these women, it's not going to be, like I said, easy to find faces who look like you doing what you want to do necessarily or making bold moves like that, because we just don't get the media coverage, but they really are happening. And here's the advantage that you have, you know, sort of mid-career, in that you are way more confident, savvy, and resourceful than you would have ever been 20 years ago. And that's the strength to play to. You have a playbook. You kind of know your personal ethics. You know how you manage people. You have a Rolodex, digital, but you have a Rolodex of people who might be motivated to help you or join you. And, you know, your 20-year younger self probably would have taken three times as long to make the decision, wouldn't have known the people, wouldn't have had as much self-confidence about how you do things. And how you do things becomes everything when you're doing something new. And so I would kind of look in the mirror and say, am I better than I was 20 years ago? Yes, damn it, I am. You know, I would hire me and take that show on to the whatever road you need to take it on more confidently than you might otherwise be inclined to do if you just looked at media examples of who is doing those kind of things, because they won't look like you as much as they should.
Oh, I love that. I think that's brilliant. I really enjoy that. It's true. We have many more resources than we know a lot more than we expect. I mean, when I'm doing career coaching and talking to clients, for example, or doing a presentation, or like I just interviewed someone on electric vehicle adoption and stuff, I find myself stepping back afterwards and going, wow, you know a lot about this. You know, it's like we surprise ourselves. We forget how much we really know and how many people we really know, right?
Right.
That's great. Thank you so much, Jules. I really appreciate you making the time again. It was great to finally meet you when you were here in DC. It's really a pleasure.
Thank you, John. Really happy to be here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today on Green Connections Radio. Jules Pierri, CEO and co-founder of The Grommet. So how do you feel about shopping online or with local entrepreneurs in person? Why have you shopped on The Grommet? Tweet it to us at Joan Michelson or post it on our Facebook page and like the page while you're there, or email it to us at info@greenconnectionsradio.com. Find us on that website, greenconnectionsradio.com, or anywhere you like to listen to podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio. Pick your platform. And if you want to gain insight from more women like us, join one of our Green Connections Mastermind groups, and you can find it on my website, greenconnectionsradio.com. I'm Joan Michelson. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.
Check out some podcasts from one of our new sponsors. About a dozen great shows focused on lifestyle industries on Mouth Media Network, with top brand executives, industry leaders, and innovators in fashion, beauty, travel, real estate, content creation, and even spirituality industries and more. Check out Mouth Media Network, powered by Sennheiser, on iTunes, Google Play, and at mouthmedianetwork.com.